Hi, you're listening to another sermon from Deep Creek Anglican Church.
I wonder if you have ever been caught with an online scam. I think I've shared the story before about how I bought a coffee machine on eBay and it was like, you know, better priced than you could ever imagine. And as soon as I pressed pay, the listing completely disappeared. As did my money, but PayPal explored and I got that back. But I mean, you know, even while I was away, I got two text messages from Australia Post telling me that I needed to pick up a parcel and I should click through here and give them all my personal details. I knew that sadly I didn't have any parcels that were on their way, so couldn't have been real. Some of us have. Tried to pay a fine, for our tolls or something via a text message. And others of us, we might not have fallen prey to a Nigerian prince, some people have had their money hijacked on its way to paying for a new house in between the conveyancer and them. This is a crazy new world. And it's only getting crazier. Now, not only do we have to be careful of what we read, what messages we get, we may not be able to trust what we can see and hear. Artificial intelligence is just coming along in leaps and bounds. And if you follow some actors or anything on social media, you might know that actors in America are striking at the moment because they for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons is they are desperate to see regulation in their contracts and in the industry for the use of AI, particularly around their images. Because technology is so amazing now that you could make an entire movie without whoever actor or actress ever showing up on set. Their image, their likeness could be used, their voice could be produced, and we'd never know what was behind what we were seeing and hearing. Now, if we did have the opportunity at every point to kind of see what's behind this, what's behind this link that's telling me to put in my personal details? What's behind this image that I'm seeing or even this video? And if we had the opportunity to, you know, see into the kind of complexity of whatever binary bits are back there, that was nice, then maybe we'd see. Maybe we wouldn't be fooled. But we don't often have that opportunity. When John is on the island of Patmos, this is the book of Revelation, he gets that opportunity. But today, something surprises him. So we read at the start of chapter 17, which Tony didn't read for us. That's okay, I didn't want him to. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand, filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. The name written on her forehead was a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of God's holy people, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. And when I saw her, I was greatly astonished. John is astonished. He marvels, he wonders at this picture. And I think it's not because it's so awful. It's because it's so beautiful. He has been seeing beast after beast, monstrosity and darkness after monstrosity and darkness. And now he sees a beautiful woman dressed in the sorts of finery that only heaven has been described in up to this point, holding a golden cup, a little bit like the golden bowls the angels had. She looks heavenly, and yet he sees the name, what's in the cup, who she's writing is not heavenly, but it's hellish. The book of Revelation, the Apocalypse of John, is an unveiling. And throughout this series, we've said it's an unveiling, a lifting off or a drawing back the curtain on the hope that we can have in this complex and suffering world. But it is also an unveiling of the evil that is at work in the ruling of our world, behind the false religion of our world. And in the past, John has seen it for what it was: monstrous, dark, destructive. These are the slides from Ben's sermon a couple of weeks ago on chapter 13. And there was a dragon and there were beasts and they looked awful. And so John could see clearly, this is evil at work. The second beast looked a bit like the lamb, but it was dark. It was false and deceptive religious influence. It was still clearly hellish. But today, he sees something gorgeous. Now, this person is a stock image, and I think she looks lovely. I'm going to take that photo to my next hairdressing appointment for certain. However, this is the contrast for John. He's been in the smoke and the abyss and the locusts and the air, and suddenly there is this gorgeous, amazing-looking, royal-looking, wealthy woman. But she's called a prostitute. Now, some translations would say harlot. That's a bit old-fashioned, but it does give a sort of nice technical ring to when we have to say the word prostitute over and over and over again in a sermon. I'd rather be saying harlot. Some translations would use the word whore, and I don't use that word, so I'm not going to do that in this sermon. However, that distasteful nature of the word is in view. It's a strong description. So why? Why is this gorgeous woman, wealthy, looking almost heavenly? Why is she called a prostitute, and what does she represent here as John is having reality unveiled? Well, throughout the scriptures, a prostitute is often contrasted with a holy and pure bride. She is, she stands for inconsistency, unfaithfulness. You heard in the reading, adultery. She is contrasted with covenant faithfulness, reliability, purity, and commitment. This is a story in Revelation, really throughout the whole of Scripture, of two contrasting women. Now, in the early parts of the Old Testament, you actually did see in the narratives kind of actual women who were functioning as prostitutes or adulterous relationships in some way, contrasted with weddings. It was a kind of, it was in the story, and you knew there was a contrast, but it was kind of presented as narrative. In the wisdom literature, Proverbs, particularly, you know, this is the way you should live. My son, follow the way of wisdom. She is like a holy bride. The Proverbs 31 woman. Don't be seduced by the adulterous lady folly, foolishness, a way of life that looks pleasurable, but in fact will lead to ruin. So this is something that has already been used commonly, but that really did have the kind of, well, the patriarchy need to make sure that they hold themselves away from, you know, the wrong stuff. Suddenly, when we come to the Old Testament prophets, the whole of the people of Israel, men, women, children, rich, poor, great, small, as Revelation might say, are needing to identify themselves either with the harlot, the unfaithful adulteress, or the holy bride. God says to them, your maker is your husband. You, this is not about men don't follow this woman, follow that woman. You, all men, women, are identified either with an adulterous, unfaithful woman who is supposed to be in relationship with God, but is turning away and is in fact in relationships with many, many other gods or idols, or a faithful bride who God is faithful to her and she is faithful to him. So when we come into the book of Revelation, it's much more about this identification with the woman. It's not who will you have a relationship with, the prostitute or the bride. It's who are you? Where do you identify? Who are you? And if there's a relationship that's being discussed, do you have a relationship with the beast or with the lamb? Now, throughout these next, really to the end of the book, this is the contrast. The harlot or the prostitute or the holy bride. And throughout, there's just language patterns that John is saying, look, I'm comparing and contrasting, and here's my symbol to you, seven angels, seven bowls. Come, I shall show you the judgment of the great harlot. Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And even the ending that I just talked to you about with the worshipping of the angel, and he says, don't do that. It happens at the end of both of these. So this is literary patterning to show us that here is the contrast, the choice, the two women whom the whole earth identifies with. And so in the just at the end, when we move into the next section, we meet the wedding of the Lamb and the bride has made herself ready. But let's come back, because the focus really in this section is on this gorgeous but terrifying destructive but disgusting woman. Why a prostitute? What does she represent? She represents the deceptive attractiveness of evil. If the temptations of this life were presented to us as their binary bits behind the scenes, we'd not go for it. If we could see that there was some hacker or scammer at the end of a computer who was actually going to take all our money and we wouldn't go for it. If evil looked like a multi-headed beast with fangs and saliva and blah, 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 we wouldn't go for it. Well, it'd be quite unlikely. I mean, I don't know what you're into, but probably not. The New Testament, as well as the Old, has already alerted us to the fact that Satan masquerades as an angel of light. He's not dumb. Evil knows that it needs to look pretty darn good. And so, to contrast Babylon, as opposed to the beasts and the dragon, we're not going to go for them. But actually, do you realize God says to John, John says to us, that you're in the midst of some pretty attractive evil. When Satan presented himself to Jesus in the wilderness, he said, look at all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. All this I will give you if you will bow down and worship me. The package is on its way. Just put in your details. All this I will give you, and then I'll take absolutely everything. And so the call from Jesus to the church at the end of chapter 16, the previous chapter, blessed is the one who stays awake. I know you want me to sing Aerosmith, but you missed it. You'll have to go back and listen to it again from the podcast. Blessed is the one who stays awake and remains clothed so as not to go naked and be shamefully exposed. Yes, you need to know that there's a battle going on. Absolutely. But that wakefulness, that alertness now comes into a new vision of attractiveness. You need to be awake and alert. Things will not always be as they seem. Maybe there's something else going on behind the scenes. And so the attractiveness is part of why a prostitute, why a woman. We're great. Okay, fine. But the actual choice of what the woman is doing, this brings more content and clarity to what is being told that we need to look out for. A prostitute's offer is tempting. It's attractive. Okay. But actually, a prostitute has to actively work to gain customers. This is not a kind of neutral zone. Wares are being plied. This is seduction. A prostitute requires payment. Actually, this is going to be costly and exploitative. You have no idea. And a prostitute defiles. This is the way in which this image is used throughout the Old Testament. Adultery, unholy, illicit sexual union is outside of God's holy purpose. And so a prostitute is a symbol of unholy attachments wherever you go. So why a prostitute? What does she represent? Well, what she represents is told to us in the text. The prostitute is called Babylon the Great. You might remember that in Revelation, the book of Daniel is used a lot. Well, in Daniel chapter 2 and chapter 4, there's a guy called Nebuchadnezzar, and he is the ruler of Babylon, which is known as Babylon the great city. So here we have that going older connection. But we know because of that language that it's likely to be symbolic because Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon, as was, is dead and gone. So the prostitute is called Babylon. But to John, Babylon has both a universal and a specific meaning. And I think it is, to him, Rome. One of the reasons why I think that is because of this little part that, again, I didn't ask Tony to read because it's insane. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. They are also seven kings. Five have fallen. One is. The other has not yet come. But when he does come, he must remain for only a little while. The beast who once was and now is not is an eighth king, but he belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. That is almost impossible for us to understand. But what is likely to be the connections outside the general symbolic of the seven is completeness, and that makes it universal. But Rome sat on seven hills. Nero was the fifth emperor. Domitian was the eighth. There's just a few little connections in there that say to the people who are reading this, yes, this is Babylon, wherever she is, at whatever time she is, but you know it's also Rome, right? You know this is the city in which you live, the powers that are governing your lives, this is them. But it's also everyone. It's multitudes and kings and rulers. And so it could be for Christians at any point. It could be for the people of God. It could be Babel in Genesis, Egypt in Exodus, Tyre in the prophets, certainly Babylon. But it could be Germany for the people of God in the Second World War, China, Iran. It could be the USA. It could be Cambodia. It could be Saudi Arabia. It could be Iraq. It could be Eritrea. It could be British Empire. It could be Russia. It could be Australia. It could be anywhere and everywhere where there is an economic, religious, and cultural system relying on leadership or power that is not God. So really this, I think, is probably the message of these chapters. Wherever the church is persecuted or Christian worship is prevented or corrupted, there the dragon is at work. Wherever the state or various ruling powers claim first and ultimate allegiance, there the beast is at work. And wherever human hearts are seduced to choose greed, love of money, reliance on commerce or career, violence, self-centeredness, ignorance of creator, false religion, unholy sex, addiction, comfort, veneration of family or beauty or health or fame or power, cruel words, exploitation of the weak. There is Babylon. There is the great prostitute. And I say this because in chapter 18, we see that wealth, commerce, industry, and economy, she's like the air in which we breathe, the water in which we swim. She's the kind of everyday life. If there's a beast and ruling powers, if there's a dragon underneath in the abyss, she's the stuff on the top that we all are part of every day. They shared her luxury. They will weep and mourn over her. The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, scarlet, every sort of wood, articles of every kind made of ivory, etc., etc., horses and carriages, and human beings sold as slaves. This is everything that is the economic, cultural, industrial complex in which we live and work, which is relying on wealth, which is greedy, and which is exploitative. Last week, we saw and we actually comforted ourselves by the fact that at the end of time, there is a battle. People are actively engaged against God. God's judgment comes on those who have actively chosen to be against him and stood under his wrath. And it looked ugly and we wanted no part in it. And we actually comforted, well, I comforted myself with this. Nobody stands under the wrath of God save those who have chosen to do so, said J.I. Packer. And we come to 17 to 19 and we have to ask the question, but what does that look like? Maybe we thought it was going to look really monstrous. Maybe it looked like this. But actually, maybe it looks like this. This is actually the terrifying message of chapters 17 to 19. That active resistance to God, like living in a relationship with the beast, could look like business as usual. It might not look monstrous, it might look absolutely gorgeous. I love Melbourne on a sunny day. Look at this, they've got the Australian Open flags, you know, it's great. I'm still kind of the Mitcham girl that loves going into the CBD. It's still exciting to me. I'm 45, come on. But the scriptures are telling us that we have to look beyond the beauty. Beyond the influence, beyond the institution, beyond actually what seems to be great and marvelous and wonderful and astonishing. So God has a call to the church. Come out of Babylon and go into the wedding feast. Revelation 18, come out of her, Babylon, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues, for her sins are piled up to heaven and God has remembered her crimes. You might remember at the start of Revelation, there is seven letters to seven churches. They're short and they say, Jesus commends you for this, but he also sees these problems and you need to repent. Well, in one of those, and we didn't have a chance, I think it would be great to have another series because you love it. You could not have more and more revelation. But we could have another series on the letters to the churches. And one of them says, I have this against you. You tolerate that woman, Jezebel. Now, that has been used say not very nice things about women in the church at times. But actually, it's a symbol, a little clue to the fact that that church is identifying with Babylon. Jezebel is just another way of saying the great harlot, the whore of Babylon. She's a queen. She says, I will never mourn. I am dressed in purple and scarlet. She's basically drunk on the blood of her adversaries. She goes after the prophets in the Old Testament. It's her. And so calling the church out of Babylon in chapter 18 is the same as saying to that little church, whoever they were, and they're everyone, of course, but might be us. Come out of Babylon. Don't tolerate, don't partner with, don't think what you are doing is pure. You've got Babylon in you. You're in her, she's in you. Do something to change because otherwise you share in her sins and you will be under her judgment. We need each other to help each other to see where we might be partnering with Babylon, identifying with Babylon in the church. Because we choose things that look like Babylon and we go, well, that's the one. You know, in the US, maybe it's about abortion. But what about greed, exploitation? What about cruel words? What about violence? What about, you know? For us, maybe it's something else. And yet, there might be this, that, but. We need to stay awake, open our eyes, and come out of her. And instead, we need to go in. We're not left out in the wilderness. It's not like you have to leave all the good things and then you've got nothing. Actually, you're going into something far, 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 far better. And I love the fact that it's this kind of simple beauty. She's Babylon's dressed in purple and scarlet, and she's dripping with everything amazing. The bride is just dressed in clean white linen, and those that are invited are the great and small. Anyone and everyone is invited to the great feast in heaven. We're going to learn more about that in the coming weeks. But I wanted to say this. It's not just judgment that we need to fear. It is actually the fact, and I sort of didn't want to do a sermon without saying, don't hold up a prostitute as the kind of, you know, this is so bad. Actually, no one's choosing that. They are being exploited. This is awful. This is done out of desperation, poverty, addiction, whatever. This is not a happy choice. And here, actually, we see almost the same thing. Eventually, Babylon, this beautiful-looking crust on the top, is destroyed by, is eaten by the beast and the dragon. They don't care about her. She might get her power from them. She seduces using their power. But ultimately, they will eat her flesh and burn her with fire. They will bring her to ruin. They will hate her. This is what evil does. And we must not feel like we're calling people to something that is bad for them if we're calling them out of Babylon. If we're saying you have to choose. Because Babylon will be destroyed. Evil eats itself. This is bad for people. You've seen a child or a friend start to change their behavior to fit in with a particular type of group, and you think, they don't care about you. They're using you. They're going to scrunch you up and throw you out. Tony and I have been chatting about Judas during the week, as we do. And I see Judas as Babylon. Because he chose to betray Jesus. But when it came down to it and he realized what he'd done, and he went back to the tribe with whom he'd aligned himself, the powers, the religious authorities, and said, oh, you need to help me. You have to take the money back. I've done the wrong thing. They said, nah, mate. Who are you to us? We don't care about you. We're not taking your money back. We're not helping you. And so, with his own complicity, and then, of course, the despair, the destruction of the evil that was truly behind, and, of course, the beast and the dragon is behind all of that, he's chewed up and spat out, and he's destroyed. So we're being called, actually, from something that not only is under judgment, not only is impure, but actually will destroy us. And we have to open our eyes to see at every point, what are the binary bits behind this? Ooh, I could do a whole thing. What are the beast's bits behind? It's the question. Who will you participate in? Who will you identify with? What will you stand in? And where will you allow influence? The harlot of Babylon or the bride of the Lamb? The great city or the holy city? Well, I do love my city. I would like her to have some more of the characteristics of the Gold Coast, to be honest, but I do love her. And I think she's visually attractive, apart from the Brown River. And I think that she's lovely. And I love living halfway to the Yarra Valley and we see the balloons. God is calling us to love this city enough to call it out of Babylon and into the holy city. He's not calling us to leave this city and start our own commune, which would be terrible because I'm awful to live with. You don't want that. He's nodding. Thank you. He's calling us to bring a city out of Babylon into reliance on allegiance to the King Jesus. He's calling us to say, I love the beauty, and there is so much that could be absolutely holy in this place. And I'm not going to stand on my entitlement and say, why don't we act like a Christian nation anymore? I'm going to say, you need to come to Jesus. I'm calling the city. I'm living in it, but not of it. And I'm looking to the holy city. We're going to stand, we're going to sing, we're going to commit ourselves. We're going to ask God, what is it that is Babylon in us? And we're going to leave, and we're going to go to the wedding feast of the Lamb.